and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Rita Lynch is in. She's a Bristol singer and her son Jimmy goes to the Bush residential unit in Hengrove. We find out what's happening down at the residential unit because it looks like the cuts are biting. Also, Alex Joseph is here to tell us about Falun Gong, whose members are being persecuted in China. But we start this week with Rita Lynch. Hi, Rita, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi there. Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself. You're a singer. How did you get into that?
Oh, God, I've been a singer for years now. I've been playing in Bristol for about 25 years. So I've just been doing it a very long time and I'm still doing it now.
How did you get into it in the first place, though?
I just kind of fell into it by knowing people in bands, and somebody asked me to play bass in a band, and then I started singing, and then I realised I had quite a good voice, and then people liked to hear me, so it just kind of snowballed and carried on, and amazingly I've been doing it for a very long time.
Okay, and we're here to talk today about your son Jimmy. Tell us about him.
My son Jimmy Lynch is 12 years old and he's quite severely autistic and epileptic. It's been quite a journey and quite a challenge, but he's doing really well and he's a really, really happy little boy. And he uses the Bush residential unit. He goes there every Monday night, one night a week, and he's been using it for the last 3 years.
Okay, well, tell us about autism and epilepsy. What does that mean?
Oh, gosh. Autism is a lifelong disability. Some people say it's not a disability, it's just a different way of processing things. But it means that the person is afflicted in three ways: with social communication, social integration, and social communication. So sometimes, you know, the spectrum is vast, it's huge. You can have people who, it doesn't seem like there's that much wrong with them, and people who, and some children haven't even, they're not even verbal, they don't actually, they can't even talk. So some of them are quite locked in and some not so much. So because it's a huge spectrum, there's a lot of autism. Also, he's epileptic. He's been he had his first seizure when he was 1 year old, and he's had a lot of seizures in his life.
Well, but it's a shame in a way. Jason Yannakopoulos isn't here. He's here most weeks, and he does a section on private eye. He looks at private eye. He's also autistic, and actually, with many people, we would, you know, you could have a chat with Jason, you'd have absolutely no idea that he had a disability.
Yes.
So tell us about the Bush residential unit in Hengrove.
The Bush residential unit is a service to give respite for the parents, to help you kind of keep on with your good work of raising your disabled child. And so it starts off as respite, and you have to get assessed by your social worker. It goes to panel, and it's assessed on need and how challenging or how severe the child's condition is. So it's to give the parent a break. And so my son stays there for one night a week, and it's to give me a little break so that I can carry on with my work of raising him. And recently we were told, the parents whose children use the Bush, on the 1st of May there was a meeting called, and we were told that the council's proposal is to reduce the beds by half. There's 10 beds at the moment and they want to take half the beds away, reduce it by
five beds. On a minute, Rita, because you've just explained to me that it's social workers, qualified professionals, that assess the need or otherwise for this. And yet the council's saying, despite the fact that the professionals have said that there's a need for this service, they're going to cut it.
They want to cut half the beds, but what they're saying is that they're saying is they're going to provide other alternatives. And the other alternatives they've come up with, the other parents, when we looked at them, we already know that they don't compete with the amazing service we get from the Bush. And one of them, the main thing they're talking about is short breaks with foster homes. They want to set up more foster homes so people could take on the role of fostering a disabled child. But the safety issues with fostering and mainly the safety issues are just they're just too much, and most of the parents wouldn't want that to happen, because I could become a foster parent, and then with a foster home anybody could walk into the home, whereas at the Bush they've got locks and there's a team of staff.
Okay, tell us a bit about the Bush then. Okay, so they can stay overnight, the children. Is it the same staff? They get used to the staff? How big is it? What sort of facilities have they got there?
Well, there's two parts on the Bush. There's 5 beds for the younger children and 5 beds for older children. My son still is in the younger children's part of it. And I think about 50 children all in all use the bush, because not everybody will have one night a week. Some will maybe have one night every fortnight. And it's whatever the parent is happy with and the child is happy with. So, and with the child, my son Jimmy, when school is finished, the bush send a car to pick him up from school, take him to the bush. And then there's three other boys roughly the same age, because my son has no friends. He finds it, because of his autism, it's very difficult for him to make friends. So there's three other boys the same age there as well on the same night. And they take them swimming, which my son loves swimming. So it's not just like a babysitting service. They actually work really hard to cater for the individual children. They make sure that the children that they have on certain nights are compatible enough that they can get on.
It sounds to me as if they are introducing foster care, then that social element is going to be gone.
Absolutely, which is one of the things we're saying, because one of the vital things for my son is that he has access to being with other boys the same age as him, because I can't really give him that. I can't just pull children up the road to be his friends, but there he's got it.
Well, you're just one parent. What are the other parents saying?
Well, what was amazing on May the 1st, when we first found out about this council proposal, is a lot of parents went there, and all the parents were saying the same thing as myself, which I was really, really really happy and really excited about, because we don't often meet each other. And we all said we want to keep the bush, that we absolutely trust, and our children love the bush. And it's not easy for our children to like things and enjoy things because of the nature of the severity of the conditions. And this is it's also catering for children with physical problems, children in wheelchairs who've got physical as well as mental, you know, issues.
The other aspect to all of this, of course, is that, you know, you've got a lot of cuts coming in. I mean, have you understood what the process is that makes this decision, and whether you can actually say no to the closure of these half of the beds at the Bush Centre? Because that seems to be the place to sort of focus your efforts on, is to say, well, you know, you are the people, we are in a democracy, you're trying to decide to close this, we're telling you no, don't, and we're lobbying you to do it. Have you been able to do that?
We have done something, but we were told quite late in the day, because apparently the council's proposal has been going on since...
Don't tell me that the decision had already been made.
They say it hasn't. The ultimate decision will be for the mayor to make the ultimate decision about whether these beds will go or not.
Okay, so have you spoken to Lord Ferguson?
I have tried and tried and tried. I've emailed him at the council house. I've got in touch with all of the councillors, nearly 70, with an email. I've tried, but people say that it's not the right address, and it's really, really hard to get hold of him. I've actually said I would just like 5 minutes just to discuss this. I'd like him to meet me, one of the parents, because he never met the parents. And we're the people who are going to be most affected by this, as in our children. And also we are... Well, almost like an invisible group of people. You don't often see our children out and about in normal society because of the nature of the disability of our children. We don't have a lot of clout in society, and you won't see as much. But when the cuts first started happening, I thought they won't really affect us, because we're too severe. But I was really amazed that they are now, that they actually want to cut from disabled children.
Well, what about the other aspect of all this, which is that children with autism particularly do need some kind of stability?
Yes,
and this is what is actually happening here, is a complete instability. You're being told, well, no, you're going to have to cut back on what's happening, and we don't know what's going to replace it. So that is actually surely not particularly good for Jimmy.
No, of course not. It took him a long time to get used to going to the bush. It took about a year and a half to 2 years for him to be really, really happy with it. And a lot of, you know, me talking to the staff and making sure we got it right. So, yeah, it would be devastating for Jimmy. It really would. And I don't... There is no way I would put him into a random foster home where, like one parent at the meeting said, you might as well hand your child to a paedophile, because there's no real safety around it. It's too unsafe.
Okay. Also, what about the wider picture, the cuts? Do you accept that, you know, we really do have to have cuts?
And no,
George Ferguson has really not... I mean, many people were expecting him to sort of wade in for Bristol against Westminster and say, we're not having these cuts, but he hasn't done that. I mean, he's obviously connected to the Merchant Venturers still, even though George Ferguson gave up his membership with the Merchant Venturers, the old slave trading organisation, when he became mayor. Of course, the merchants still invite him back because, oh, we've got to invite the mayor, haven't we, to the merchants' dues.
Yes.
So he's still connected in with that sort of city elite. But what are your thoughts about the necessity or otherwise for these cuts?
I don't think they're necessary at all. I think there's a lot of money. I think there's loads of money to go around. It's just that it's in the hands of rich people and greedy people. I think if we tax the rich more and take money from people who've got a lot of money, not take it from disadvantaged...
The Merchant Venturers have got a lot of money. George Ferguson himself is a millionaire.
He should dip his hand into his own pocket then, because what they're saying is that there's more and more disabled children coming up through the system. and they have one certain pot of money that's got to go round. There was no talk about increasing that pot of money, even though there's going to be more and more disabled children apparently coming into the system. So instead of putting more money in, they just want to make the money go round. That's why they want to take half the beds, because apparently it's £250 a night for one child to use the bush. And it's all about saving money.
It's a bit concerning, isn't it, when we see some of the most vulnerable people in our society, particularly children, being affected by this. I remember, whatever it was, probably 2 years ago now, the closure of the Remploy. It does almost seem that this government is targeting disabled people.
Yes, they are. I think they really are, because I think for a lot of reasons, I think there's a lot of prejudice against disabled people, because maybe they're never going to be useful in society, that maybe they're never going
to
work.
Well, isn't it maybe to do with they're not productive enough? They're not producing GDP, you're not producing stuff. Yes. And this is a very pernicious idea. It's almost like the law of the jungle.
Yes, it is. And because they will never be productive, they probably have to be looked after. My son will have to be looked after probably all his life.
Well, in a way, it's a sort of test, isn't it, if society can look after its most vulnerable. It's a kind of test, Rita.
I thought it was. I thought it was the mark of a society, of how well it looks after its disadvantaged and disabled people. You know, you can judge a society on how well it is. And I think what George Ferguson wants to do is really cruel, really brutal, and really he should pick on somebody his own size and leave these children. There's not... Because what he's saying with the foster care and these other options is that we can have them, but nothing compares to the safety and the trust that we have at the bush unit. And they have the facilities there, the team of staff, and there's a team of staff, not just one person. And so it just feels so safe.
Now, one of the things that you think about in situations like this is people maybe should write to the mayor and ask him about this and tell him to change his mind or whatever. But one gets the idea that you've kind of failed to get through.
I've tried and tried. I mean, they say that you can get through, but I've tried many times and I can't seem to...
When does he come out in public?
Well, apparently he does quite a lot. I heard recently that the Fleece and Firkin, the music venue, was thought it might lose its licence because they wanted to make flats. Apparently he went along to see the manager there and he said that he's going to help him. Mm. So he's prepared to help like a live music venue, which is all very well and good, but really it's not the same as... But on the other hand, he wants to take away from these disabled children. It just seems very low.
Okay, so if Jimmy isn't able to go for respite care there, how's that going to affect you, Rita?
Enormously, absolutely, because I wouldn't, there's no way I would put him into a foster home because I'm his mother, he doesn't need a foster mother. He would stay with me and it would just make our lives a lot more difficult.
Well, just tell us and explain, you know, what it means to you once a week to have that respite care. How important is it?
Well, it's something I can rely on, and I've been relying on it now for about 2 years since Jimmy really settled in there. I was only saying to somebody just before I heard about this proposal that our lives are so much more organised, especially in the summer holidays when it's really, really, really quite difficult and challenging. I can rely on that one night, and I know he's really happy. In fact, he looks forward to going. Jimmy won't understand if the beds get reduced. What some people I've talked to are saying is that it won't affect Jimmy, but then I feel that they're going to be put, some parents, maybe they're going to put pressure on them to maybe go for foster care, but some of us will not accept that at all and maybe will be allowed to use the service, but it won't be the same service if it doesn't facilitate a lot of children, because part of it is the social aspect that these children get.
What does it say about our society and our city when we can't look after these youngsters?
Well, it doesn't bode well for the future. It's really frightening because parents like myself, you know, we're not going to be around when our children, you know, are older and grown up. And it just means that the future looks really frightening and... Really frightening, and I'm worried for the future for these children.
Well, let's appeal to George publicly right now to do something
about
this.
Yes, please, George, do not reduce the beds at the bush. We need it. You really don't know what you're doing, and it will be a false economy because the knock-on effect of what it will do to families will end up costing you so much more and actually really shaming you. So just leave it alone.
Well, I wonder whether George is playing a bit of a public relations game with the way he's dealing with the city. He obviously seems to get on very well with the Bristol Post, the newspaper. They seem to print quite a lot of positive stuff about him. He's also got his kind of it's called the Canteen, isn't it, in Stokes Croft. This is his, and it's also kind of right in the middle of Bristol's alternative community. There's George's kind of big PR exercise.
Yes, I'm sure he wants us all to think he's quite an arts-loving, nice, sort of decent man with his red trousers and stuff, whatever, but really what he's doing with these disabled children is it doesn't show him up in a good light, and I think it will ultimately really shame him, and he should just leave it alone.
Okay, Rita Lynch, thanks very much for joining us on
Dialect. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined now by Alex Joseph. Hi, Alex. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Now, you are from this organisation called Falun Gong. Tell us about Falun Gong.
I'm a volunteer of Falun Gong. I started practising 2 years ago. Now, Falun Gong is also known as Falun Dafa. It is a meditation exercise based on the principles of truth, compassion, tolerance. So it's a practice which can help mind and body, and can help the physical well-being through exercises and developing one's character.
Now, it sounds a little bit like yoga. Tell us what you actually do as part of Falun Gong.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, the first part, the exercises, there are five very simple exercises and one sitting meditation exercise. The exercises are what people may call Qigong. They incorporate very simple movements which can be used to open up energy channels, help the strength of the body, and just basically used to kind of cover the energy channels.
Okay, now you use this the word energy channels quite a lot. Now, most people wouldn't necessarily understand what that means. What is an energy channel?
For me to say what an energy channel is, just to put it very simply, in acupuncture, which is commonly known, they target what they call energy channels, and the body is covered in them.
So, are they like nerves?
It's different to nerves. I'm not a specialist on the matter, to be honest with you. My understanding of energy channels is something on a deeper deeper thing that I couldn't put into words.
Okay, so these are sort of ways that says there is energy going through your body, quite obviously.
That's right.
Some of it's going through nerves, not all of it may be going through nerves, and this is what you're focusing on. So, I mean, is it, if you, when you're doing these exercises, do you look like you're doing yoga, or what was it? What are you actually up to?
It looks similar to Tai Chi. It does look very similar to Tai Chi. Of course, that is a different system of practice, and as I said, it's a lot simpler.
Okay, so how did you get interested in Falun Gong, Alex?
Well, it was approximately 2 years ago. I was looking through on the internet, looking to find a system of discipline. Initially, I came across a lot of martial arts, and then I came across something called Qigong. And at the time, I had no idea what Qigong was at all. So I went a bit further, and up flashed up was Falun Gong and Falun Dafa. And I saw Master Li Hongji doing the exercises on YouTube. And it really caught my attention because it was slow, gentle, peaceful movements.
So is that what you weren't maybe attracted to by the more traditional martial arts? Because they're actually quite sort of physical contact sports, some would call contact sports anyway, and they can be quite aggressive, one might even say.
Yeah, because as I said, my initial interest was for self-discipline. It was to improve myself, to have more peace with myself, to basically, you know, learn how to get through this kind
of... But there's some people, they'll just say, oh, I'm going to join the gym. Why didn't you do that?
Well, that's about exerting energy. And I needed something which was just going to allow me to be a lot more peaceful and self-disciplined. Throughout my life, I've always been quite athletic, playing football, doing long-distance running and everything. And funnily enough, at the time, I was kind of doing running every day. And it was something about running where I felt that it wasn't satisfying me mentally. Physical accomplishments are relatively easy for me, in some ways, sorry. But it's something that I needed to really bring together my mind and my body.
Sounds like, you know, you weren't satisfied with the what you were getting from it spiritually. You were thinking maybe, well, I need to do something a bit more meditative. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. That's the only way you can put it, really.
I mean, what is it that you think drives people to do run every day? I mean, it's obviously quite good to keep fit and healthy. But do you think sometimes people get a little bit obsessed by it?
Well, I would never want to pass judgment on other people's inner ambitions, what they want to do. But, you know, physical exercise is about being fit and healthy. Sometimes the body does need to sweat and it needs to get rid of toxins. The body does need to exert some energy to get the blood circulation going, etc. Meditation exercise, from what I've experienced, works on a different way, where stillness and clearness is what's very important. And that is something which requires a different form of practice. It's something which anyone can do, but it requires something which we don't commonly do in this environment, and that is being still.
Now, you've been doing this for a couple of years, you say.
Yeah.
Has it actually affected your wider life, do you think?
In many ways. We only have a limited amount of time, so I'll be concise. Physically, I am not so much concerned about ailments or illnesses or any worry about me internally or physically. Obviously, things came up occasionally, you know, there may be a strain somewhere, but that's something I can understand where that's happening. In terms of my perspective on life, so to call it, or what I'm doing, things have become a lot easier. I used to, I won't say suffer, but anxiety was a common thing for me. If you were to ask me 3 years ago to come on a show and talk about something as profound as meditation, I probably would have broke out in a sweat and ran away. So confronting things and doing what needs to be done, being proactive, responsible, these are things which I've really feel like I've improved on personally. In terms of my family life and social life, that is improved in ways where I don't have that resentment. Like many children or people growing up, there was differences between parents. My parents broke up when I was in my teens, and you know, I did hold a lot of resentment for a long time. And you know, I didn't really think too much about it, but throughout the course of practicing Falun Dafa, I found that these negative feelings I had towards family members, towards parents, that they're not necessary. And as a whole, my negative feelings towards, you know, this group of people or this type of people, they're not necessary. And if I was to stand here and say I've let go of all of them, I probably wouldn't be honest with you. But I recognize that having them is not useful. They are literally like a weight on my mind. You know, they're sort of things that, you know, could keep one awake at night, the one that can, you know, really cloud one's thinking and not be able to be kind to people. So as a whole, I'm able to be a lot more kinder to people. Not nice, as in nice to get what I need, but true kindness and understand what kindness means. And it's an ongoing journey. It's an ongoing journey, but it's one worth travelling for.
Well, I think anyone that's regularly in the gym pounding away, you know, I think that's an interesting thought, you know, that maybe it's not just the physical, it's the mental and the spiritual that people should be thinking about. So anyway, let's come on to the wider question about Falun Gong, which is why I particularly asked you on, Alex, is is because I understand that there's quite a lot of persecution of the organisation.
As you can tell, Falun Gong is a sort of thing that's a very personal practice to oneself.
But just get it clear, is it originate from China?
Let's say it was brought to the public through China in the early 90s. That would probably be the best way to put it. It spread very quickly from 1992 up until 98. You were looking at 70 to 100 million people practicing Falun Dafa. So that is a very, very high growth. Something that the Communist Party, well, they were appreciative of it to begin with, because, of course, it was saving them a lot of money. People haven't had to spend so much money on their health service, so, you know, saving the government a lot of money they were happy with. But when they saw that it was something which they couldn't really control, they couldn't control people's independence, they couldn't control the numbers exceeded the number of Communist Party members, they feared this. They wanted to control this, they couldn't. So as of July the 20th, 1999, they set out on quite a widespread, dark persecution. Of course, there were steps leading up to that. From 1994, but it was really 1999 where it was really widespread.
Well, that gives us a bit of an idea of how things work in China. I mean, I think there's, it's probably fair to say our government doesn't like certain activities, but how is it, are the Chinese government, how have they practically, have they banned the organisation, for example? I mean, are we talking about police raids, this sort of thing?
Well, that's the problem they have. It's not a rigid organisation. It's not a religious party. It's not a membership organisation. It's very, very loose. It's very informal. So they find that very hard. So what they've actually gone into is attacking groups of people. As I mentioned, back in the early 90s, people would join in the hundreds or thousands to do the exercises in the parks, etc. And it was very peaceful. And people do that before they go to work and after work. But when the persecution began in 1999... they stopped all that. They were literally carting people off into riot vans and all sorts of malicious tactics to persecute people. And the persecution spread from, as I mentioned, to arresting people, to torturing people, to using them for their...
Torture? I mean, organs. This is for basically for meditating in the park.
Essentially, yes.
And for being part of this organisation. So did they formally ban it and say you're just simply not allowed to do this?
They set about a range of propaganda, and this is probably where it's really affected us over here in the West, because the propaganda they set up was quite easy for the Communist Party, because obviously they control the media, they control the newspapers, they control what people say, they have posters everywhere. So, you know, when they decided that, you know, Falun Gong was something that they needed to eradicate, they used the media in quite unfortunate way, because obviously not only did journalists and media people not have their freedom to work anyway, now they're being forced to report on something which was all lies, essentially. And, you know, some of the things they were saying about Falun Dafa were damaging to themselves and the general public of China, because you have to remember China is roughly about one-fifth of the world population. So that's a lot of people being lied to and kept in the dark. So it wasn't just the damage they were trying to do to the practitioners at the time, it was to the general public.
And so did they succeed in, I mean, I would imagine, I mean, this often happens with, particularly with spiritual movements, is that it's driven underground.
I wouldn't say they've succeeded. Falun Dafa has practiced over 100 countries across the world. Within China, the persecution is still going on. Outside of China, there are more practitioners. In the UK alone, there is a good number of practitioners.
But have the Chinese government actually given any real reasons why they think that this is such a dangerous thing, that it needs to be outlawed?
Well, their basis for their attacks is not based on rationality. So everything that follows has been very irrational.
So what are they accusing Falun Gong of doing? Having some sort of subversive organisation against the government? Or, I mean, that would be the easiest thing for a dictatorship. Well, it's not a dictatorship, is it? But it's an extremely authoritarian regime. That's the easiest thing for an authoritarian regime, is to stop any kind of movement that they don't like, is to say they're trying to subvert the country, they're trying to subvert the government. Have they said that?
Over here in the West, they are not so open about talking about Falun Gong, to my knowledge, that is. Of course, I'm a volunteer, so, you know, I have to speak from my own experiences. But, you know, it's mainly in China where the suppression has been very direct, and they are still persecuting people on quite a high level. The number of deaths are still quite high, and the number of people who are being tortured are still quite high. So
what I don't understand, what I think I really cannot get my head around, Alex, is why you, or what information you would try and extract through torture of someone who'd been meditating. I do not understand that.
Yeah, well, I haven't experienced it, so I couldn't say exactly what they're trying to get out of people.
Maybe they're just trying to find out who are the organisers of the group or whatever. This is pretty amazing, pretty scary stuff, and it gives us a complete different picture of what seems to be an attempt maybe to rehabilitate China in the West, you know, to say, oh, well, they're now just our business partners, they're our friends.
Yeah, and I guess the part where I really touched a part of me where I felt I needed to do something was the fact that I benefited from practicing Falun Dafa. We spoke about that earlier. And when I look at the persecution, I don't so much just see Chinese people being persecuted. That is something on a surface level. What is actually being persecuted is the principles of truth, compassion, tolerance, which is basically what makes up our morals. So what the Communist Party are doing, they are persecuting human moral values, and they've done it in such a way where they've been able to continue their business with our government or many businesses across the world. So many people that do business with China now, they're not being told the truth of what the Communist Party are like, which is unfortunate for business. It's like doing business with someone that has a dark, hidden problem with their family or with people that they work with within their own office. And it's something which cannot really work successfully. So what happens is that, you know, the more that we kind of have these connections with China without actually knowing the truth, the more damage that can be done in ways which we can't see.
Well, thankfully, there's no persecution of Falun Gong yet in Bristol. So just give us an idea where you meet with your fellow practitioners and, you know, if people are interested, how they can come along and give it a go.
There are three practice sites in Bristol. There is one in Hannam that runs on a Thursday. There is two in the centre of Bristol. One is on a Monday evening at 7:30 at the Island, which is the old Bridewell police station. There's another one on a Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, and that is in Castle Park underneath the bandstand. And it's an opportunity for people to come and learn the exercises. If they want to find out a bit more, there are other practitioners there, but it's predominantly for people to learn the exercises, because of course it's a personal thing, and you know, the first part for many people is learning the exercises, and you know, just coming out and learning exercises alone can be a benefit to some people.
And whereabouts can we find you on the internet? I imagine you've got some sort of sign, and you might even want to give a number for people to contact the group locally.
If I give you the web address, which is www.falundafa.org.
You better spell that.
Sorry, that's true. www.falundafa, spelled FALUNDAFA.org.
Okay, and is there a phone number locally?
Yes, I could give you my phone number. My number is 079-43-212193.
Okay, Alex Joseph from Falun Gong, Falun Dafa, whatever you want to call it in Bristol. More power to your elbow, mate. And good, very, very good to have you on. And I'll give you your number at the end of the programme for listeners if they didn't have a chance to write it down there. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
To see. heart is pure. Done just for thee. The moment passing by, standing with her master. Her mind is clear. Inside so still. Immortal grace, frozen in time, the heavens meet. A heart, a divine. For the world to see,
gentle bit of music was by Leadville Jim. It was called China Be Free, and that music was supplied to us thankfully by Alex Joseph from Falun Gong. Thanks very much, Alex, for coming in, and I'll give his number at the end of the show.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Tech Roundup time, and Elia Pablo's joining me. Elia, Facebook again this week. They seem to be being naughty in the news week after week after week, but they're in the news again this week with another scandal about an experiment that they conducted in 2012. Where the results were published last weekend. So what can you tell us about that survey?
Hello, first of all. Yeah, this experiment was conducted by a group of researchers from the Cornell and the California universities. And what they did was to manipulate the news feed of the Facebook of 6,089 people. For, like, to be clear, the news feed is the main page on Facebook where you see all the news and posts and image of your friends.
Okay, so hang on a minute, because you're talking about how many thousand people?
6,089 people.
Okay, the key thing is here that, you know, if you've got, say, 20 friends, 100 friends, 1,000 friends, all sorts of stuff can come up there, and from any of those friends, in any order. But I've noticed one of the things on Facebook is that I would like all of my stuff from all of my friends to come up there. But Facebook has decided that it's just going to choose for me which of those posts it likes and put those in front of me. And every time I go on there, I have to click actually to see all posts rather than what Facebook has decided are the top posts. So I've noticed that Facebook do that. But is this experiment to do with that, so manipulating the news feed in that same way?
No, let me answer first how do they do it. Like, how does Facebook normally work? The news feed is kind of logic. Imagine you have like 300 friends. You cannot see the post of 300 people. So what they do is like they score each post, each story, regarding how many, like your relationship with the people that post the news, and how many likes, shares, and actually comments the story has. And then on the top of your newsfeed, you will have the most successful stories. So it's kind of logical. I actually agree with it. They have to be a way to just decide which ones are more interesting and which not. What they did, though, that was different. They basically manipulate the newsfeed because they were concerned about this widespread idea that seeing the positive life and the good things that our friends do on Facebook make us jealous and makes us unhappy. So because of the privacy duties in Facebook, they couldn't actually get into the accounts. But they created an algorithm to select positive words and negative words. They divided these guinea pigs into groups. One of them, they manipulate the newsfeed so they get just posts with positive words. And the other one, just negative words. And what they saw is that the mood changed. So basically, the person that were getting good states, good stories, they were more likely to get like positive news stories, to actually post news, good things, and the opposite for the other group.
Okay, but that's completely separate from what I was talking about.
Exactly, yeah, it's different.
Anyone that uses Facebook, I would recommend every once in a while you go on to the top of your Facebook page and you click see all of all the posts on your newsfeed, and you find there's actually quite a lot of stuff in there that you might have been interested in, but Facebook has decided for whatever reason, and I understand you agree with it, they've got to find some way, but it's, you're not getting everything, you're just getting a kind of selection of of what various people on Facebook, and also there's very little, very difficult to check to see if what Facebook is putting in front of you is really what is the most popular post of any of your friends. And your explanation of this little test that Facebook have been doing on positive and negative is proof, really, proof of the pudding, is that they can manipulate
that. Exactly, they can.
Now, they didn't ask anybody.
No, they didn't.
And why did they do it? Why did they do it, do you think?
Well, they said it's because they care about people. So I'm first of all going to read a post that one of the researchers put on Facebook after like all the criticism. So he basically said, the reason we did this research is because we care about the emotional impact of Facebook and the people that use our product. We felt that it was important to investigate the common worry that seeing friends post positive content leads to people feeling negative or left out. At the same time, we were concerned that exposure to friends' negativity might lead people to avoid visiting Facebook. So that's the reason he stated they did it. So they apologized because the paper that published their research wasn't clear about the reason or whatever. But what I personally think is naive to actually think they just do it for our benefit. They actually do it for market research. And it's actually quite intelligent to do it because they have the power of actually changing people's mood.
The other thing, of course, is you don't get an unlike button, do you, on Facebook. It's not a dislike button or an unlike.
No,
you can unlike
not.
Something actually if you've changed your mind about whether you like it or not, but it's like, it's you're expressing something positive about something.
Yes.
And I think in a way this is one of the things I quite like about it, is it builds out negativity. So if you don't like something, well, forget about it and move on. But if you do like something, you can express it on Facebook. I worry though a little bit about the way that Facebook was created, who's behind it, how close they are to the big intelligence agencies we've heard so much about over the last year. So is there anything that that Facebook does without its users' knowledge? What do you think?
I'm sure they are. There are plenty of things they can do. They just did that. They claim it's legal because it's actually in the use and terms of Facebook. But they can. We were talking the other day about publicity, about this new tool that actually you can change your taste and things like that. They can imagine for 1 second, it's in their best interest to change a society move just before an election. They can do it.
Okay, just to talk a bit about the origins of Facebook, as I was saying, one of the major people that created Facebook is not actually Mark Zuckerberg. It was the guy that funded it originally, where most of the money is someone called Peter Thiel, T-H-I-E-L. He's quite an interesting character, and he's got a consultancy called Palantir Technologies. And they raised money in December last year, $9 billion valuation, making Thiel's estimated 12% stake in Facebook worth more than $1 billion. He's also a co-founder of PayPal, this guy. So in a way, we're looking at these organizations, but we're not really seeing who's controlling them, who's running them. And PayPal, of course, is an extremely powerful organization. We've had in the past, for example, PayPal pull accounts from people they don't like. So if they don't like you, Elia, PayPal have the power to say, well, we're going to stop her internet account. They've done this recently to a startup I noticed, which was providing secure, free internet email. And PayPal, funded by the same guy, founded by the same guy, Peter Thiel, just decided that this new idea of having an alternative to Gmail or Hotmail or whatever, which was secure, he was going to pull their PayPal account. So this is really, I mean, you've got a lot of power with these, particularly with these internet banking type people. Anyway, what with all the criticism of Facebook, are you still using it?
So that's the thing. We are completely relying on Facebook, Twitter. That's the problem. There were like lots of threats saying, oh, we should just all quit, like close our accounts on Facebook. But how many people do you know they have actually done anything? After everything we know, after everything we'll be talking about here, did you close your account? I didn't.
No, because we use it to basically keep in touch with people nowadays. I notice as well that people are sending emails less. They will maybe message somebody on Facebook, whereas they might in the old days have sent someone an email,
yes,
or maybe texted them. And of course, this gives Facebook ownership of all these communications. And then what does that do? That helps with marketing. I just wonder, Elio, what your thoughts are about where this is headed. Do you think maybe there'll be one corporation on the internet controlling everything at some point, everything we do?
It could be. It could be like a big brother. I'm more thinking about like giants, like we have already Google, Facebook controlling WhatsApp. So I don't know if at some point they will have like a big corporation that will control everything and it will have different members. It could be, but it's quite scary what you were saying before about this guy that...
Peter Thiel.
Yeah, that guy. That's the thing. We rely so much on internet. We cannot... If they don't want to, we can't really fight against them.
Well, you see, the thing is, we see, it's a bit like going to a petrol station. You know, you see a different logo on the petrol garage, but maybe the same guy owns the shares in Texaco and owns the shares in Shell. This is how Peter Thiel's operating. You think that you're using a different service when you go to PayPal and a different service when you go to Facebook, but actually, you're just using two parts of Peter Thiel, who's a billionaires' services that he's providing in a way. Any other thoughts about privacy, though? Because, I mean, for example, this site that I was telling you that PayPal have pulled the account from, is it the sort of thing you would think of using as a free email but secure?
It would be quite useful. I didn't hear about it, to be honest, but...
Well, it didn't really get much of a chance to get started now before it's been killed off.
Exactly.
It's a startup. It will last only a few weeks.
And I just remember, like, your story about sending a message, well, an article through Gmail, and then they didn't receive it.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So,
that's
like,
chilling,
that
isn't
would
it?
Be a good idea to use it.
I've noticed, actually, also Press TV, the Iranian state channel. I was emailing them the other day. I emailed them on their Press TV account. They emailed me back on their Gmail account. And I said, well, why are you using Gmail? Oh, we find it's better if we use the Press TV account, the people sometimes don't get the messages on Gmail accounts. So, because so many of the people that they're talking to have got Gmail accounts. Mm. And as Google are getting this monopoly on people using Gmail, what they're doing is they're using it to force people, even people who've got their own emails, to go on to Gmail as well. Pretty a lot of power. Anyway, we were also chatting just before we started, Elio, about this website called The Intercept. Now, this is quite a good one. I'll just read out a couple of stories from the recent ones. This is one of the ones that Glenn Greenwald, who is the Brazilian guy who'd done a lot of journalism around the Edward Snowden, he had... was given a massive amount of information by Edward Snowden. He's been slowly going through it, these technical leaks from the NSA and GCHQ, and giving out things bit by bit over the last year or so. And a couple of stories. I just want to get your thoughts on this. There is possible legal action over secret hacking programs, but one of the stories that caught my eye this year, back in the end of April, was British spy chief secretly begged to play in the NSA's data pools. British surveillance agency GCHQ secretly coveted the NSA's vast troves of private communications and sought unsupervised access to its data. As recently as last year, the classified documents provided by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden reveal. So it shows that the NSA... are seen to be the big guys, and all these little European countries, they're begging to have a slice of the action, a slice of the information.
Well, it's what we were talking about. Just imagine the NSA is saying, oh, like, we are actually just looking after non-American citizens, but then if they need help, they will go for the GCHQ. So exactly the same would happen on the other direction.
But anyway, I think Glenn Greenwald and others have done a fantastic job in getting this out to the public. But I noticed just literally this week, last-minute US government claims put a halt to the Green World bombshell. Well, this is very frustrating. I noticed on Glenn Greenwald's Twitter account, he's saying, well, we were about to publish a massive story this week, because he'd been talking it up, I think the NSA realised what he was about to release, and so they've launched some sort of attempt to stop him publishing the story. That I find so chilling, where we're told there's going to be a massive story released at midnight, and then the next day we're told, sorry, we can't tell you.
Yes, it's just welcome to the free speech and the democracy.
That's right. Anyway, it's at midday this week, on Monday this week, journalist Glenn Greenwald announced that revelations he's termed among the most important to result from documents leaked by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden will be published at midnight. However, despite a growing anticipation on Monday and hours prior to the expected publication, Greenwald went back to Twitter. Seems the whole world works on Twitter nowadays. Yeah. And announced, after 3 months working on our story, US government today suddenly began making last-minute claims which we intend to investigate before publishing. That's what he said on Twitter. As of noon on Tuesday, the report was still not showing on The Intercept, the online outlet edited by Greenwald, where much of his most recent reporting on the documents has appeared. And the website for that, if anyone's interested in The Intercept and following it, and you can follow it on Twitter too, I'm sure, is at firstlook.org. That's FIRSTLOOK, firstlook.org/ The Intercept, one word, The Intercept. In various venues in recent months, Greenwald has suggested the most explosive bombshell, and he calls it a bombshell, reporting based on the documents would come last and recently discussed. Now, the focus of the reporting will reveal specific individuals or kinds of people the NSA is targeting inside and outside the United States with its collected-all approach to digital surveillance. So really, what he was about to announce last night, it's pretty clear, is the specific types of individuals that we're told that this is a trawl right around the internet, but actually it's not. The specific types of people. I wonder if it's you, Elliot. I wonder if it's me. Anyway, we probably won't find out now. I'd just like you to leave us with one thought, which is a recommended place that you go online to get some decent news and information, because I get fed up with throwing things at the TV, switching the TV off. Whereabouts do you think is quite a good place to go and get news online?
I don't really rely just on one site. Where I rely is I have these friends that I follow, and they always publish some interesting that's what I like some people publishing, like the story of today, just a friend pop up on Facebook yesterday, and I thought, that's interesting, what did Facebook do, and I start researching about it. So I'm sorry, I cannot really recommend it one.
No, that's okay. No, because in a way, it's a bit like the grapevine, isn't it? It's a bit like, you know, talking over the garden wall to people about what's going on.
Exactly.
And Facebook does allow you to do that right across the world.
And one interesting thing is, like, we were talking just before starting the program, it's not about BBC anymore, TV, normal press. You just go through different ways, because your friends read to this post that it hasn't been in the main media, and you actually get it there, and you wouldn't have done it without the social media.
Okay. Elliot Pablo, thanks again for the Tech Roundup. Thank you. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week. That was Alex Joseph, you heard talking about Falun Gong, and also Rita Lynch about her son Jimmy and the Bush residential unit in Hengrove. Not to forget, of course, Elia Pablo and the Tech Roundup. And also, Alex's number, as I promised I would repeat at the end of the show, is 07943 212 193. That's 07943 212 193. And his website, falundafa.org. I'm Tony Gosling. See you next week.
cookie.